Welcome, Friends of Wildlife, to Protect Our Wildlife's podcast, Untamed. I am Brenna Galdenzi, and I'm the president and co-founder of Protect Our Wildlife, Vermont's number one all-volunteer wildlife protection advocacy nonprofit. In this new podcast series, we will be speaking freely about many issues impacting wildlife in Vermont and how you can help. The animals only have us, and we take being their voice seriously. Today, we'll be talking about grassroots activism with Ashley McCavey. Ashley is the founder of the all-volunteer group Vermont for Wildlife. They began as Ivory Free Vermont in 2012 with the main objective of banning the sale of imperiled wildlife parts, including ivory and rhino horn, right here in Vermont. Ashley is a busy mom of two and is a graduate of Yale and Yale School of the Environment. And her hope is that Vermont, by becoming the 12th state to do the right thing, will spur on the remaining 38 states to act. We can't think of a better person to motivate our listeners to start their own grassroots campaign than Ashley. So welcome, Ashley.
Thank you, Brenna. It's an honor to be here. I'm delighted.
And I've known you now, I can't believe it's been almost a decade, but I remember when I first met you in Burlington, your passion, I mean, it just came through in your eyes and everything about you. I just knew that this woman is serious about what she's doing. And I loved it because I felt the same, or I feel the same way about my cause. And so I just would like to share with our listeners, you know, how did you first become involved with this particular cause?
And, yeah.
You know, when did your love for elephants and rhinos begin?
So I think, I mean, I was born loving nature and loving animals for sure. And when I was 16, I was very, very fortunate, very blessed. I was able to go to Zimbabwe. I was so wanting to go to Africa, and I had this incredible opportunity, and I went to Zimbabwe, and I fell in love. I fell in love with everything, really, truly opening my eyes to the beauty and just how precious the wildlife is there and the amazing people fighting to protect that very wildlife. It became so evident to me. We were able to go one day to a nature preserve where I met these rangers who were literally risking their lives to protect this wildlife, elephants, rhinos, giraffe. And it was just, it was beyond eye-opening because these people were risking their lives to protect these animals from a trade that wasn't benefiting and happening in Africa. It was coming to America and Asian countries. And it became so clear to me how wrong this was. At that particular reserve, I had the chance to bottle feed a baby black rhino. And it was, I think it was that moment, just looking in the eyes of this beautiful creature who just lost its mother in a horrifically violent way. It ingrained in part of my soul, the injustice of it, and that it was something I had to pay attention to. So for the next many, many years, I studied wildlife, endangered wildlife, the wildlife trafficking trade. And it really was the 2012 cover story of the National Geographic magazine about how incredibly bad the situation was that really woke me up and spurred the Vermont movement, if you will.
Yeah, I think you've explained it. I mean, looking into the eyes of a baby black rhino, bottle-feeding that little orphan, I can completely understand why that set you on your path to want to be their voice and protect them. And, you know, whether it's something as moving as spending a month or a summer in another country in Zimbabwe like you did, or, you know, my kind of launching point into my activism was quite different. And I know a lot of our listeners have heard this story, so bear with me. I don't want to be one of those people that sounds like a broken record, but I never know who's listening and if there's new folks who haven't heard this story before, so bear with me. But you know, what kind of catapulted me into activism here in Vermont was about 11 years ago, I saw a photo of a bobcat with its paw, you know, crushed between the jaws of a metal trap. And I saw a man standing behind the bobcat with his thumbs up, looking very proud of himself. And, you know, just the bobcat's eyes, you know, looking at me in that photo, just terrified. And you could tell the animal was obviously in pain. And I remember looking at one of my fellow volunteers saying, I hope somebody contacted the Vermont game warden about this. This is animal abuse. This is terrible. I hope this man was arrested. And that is when I found out that this was a completely legal practice using leg hole traps to trap bobcats and other wildlife. And not only was it legal, it was endorsed and promoted by our state Fish and Wildlife Department. So, you know, my starting point for activism was much different from yours. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what caused a person to become interested in the cause. But when you see something like that, that moves you, whether it's bottle feeding a baby black rhino or seeing a photo of a bobcat in a leg hole trap, to kind of take that passion and to take that concern and that willingness or that, you know, wanting to help to the next level is everything. And I think you'll be able to really encourage and motivate people on our call today, Ashley.
I hope so. And you're absolutely right, Brenna. I mean, I think it's paying attention to those moments in your life that leave a mark and not sweeping it under the carpet or just hoping it will go away or hoping that someone else will take care of it. If you are moved by something, and obviously you and I are wildlife activists, it can be anything, though. It can be anything that deeply moves you. I beg people to pay attention to that. Don't sweep it away. Don't think someone else is going to take care of it, because they won't. This is on you.
Exactly. And there's a saying, and I hope I don't muck it up right now, but if it's not you, who? If not now, when? Right. And you know, that's something that I always think about. So on this podcast, you are going to provide our listeners with everything they need to know, Ashley, to become a successful grassroots activist. So no pressure.
Absolutely. I can do this. No problem.
So can you explain to our listeners why your efforts to ban the sale of ivory and rhino horn and other wildlife parts from exotic species, why that was so vital here in Vermont, especially since it is already restricted under the federal regs? I know there was some confusion among not only Vermonters, but legislators. So can you help explain that to us?
Yes, definitely. So as I mentioned, it was that incredible experience in Africa, and then me just kind of hoping and praying that things will get better. And then it was that 2012 cover story, that National Geographic cover story, that it just was this complete call to arms. It was a wake-up call. And when I read it, I said, okay, I have to do something. And that's the thing that I think is really important for your listeners. I didn't know where to begin, but you just begin. You do something. And it's amazing how that one thing leads to the next, leads to the next. And now we have this incredible law here in Vermont. But at that moment in 2012, when I read that cover story, I started right there. I said, okay, who wrote this? It was written by Brian Christie. What is it about? It's about this movie done by the incredible producer, John Hemingway, called Battle for the Elephant. So I said, you know what? We need to get this film to Vermont. So we brought the film to Vermont. I did. And it was this incredible success story. Ira Allen Chapel was completely packed. And there was a great panel discussion at the end. And the one word that came out crystal clear was legislation. I mean, everyone in that chapel was scratching their head saying, what can we do? What can we do to stop this extinction crisis for a trade that's perfectly legal in the United States on a state level? And it became clear it was legislation. And I, just as you said, I thought, well, what do you mean legislation? Isn't it already illegal? Similar to what you thought when you saw the bobcat getting mangled in a trap. And it became clear, no, it's not illegal. It is perfectly free and clear, this trade in imperiled wildlife parts on a state level. And what we became aware of was that federal law only governs import, export, and interstate trade. And the trade that happens within a state is up to the state itself. So at that time in 2012, when I started this kind of information gathering, it became very clear that all 50 states had free and clear trade in these imperiled wildlife parts. And so that was kind of the big wake-up call. And in 2014, New Jersey was the brave, very first state to take a stand. And that helped us, helped pave the way to where we are now, Vermont becoming the 12th state.
I remember, I forget when it was, it might have been back in 2015, I testified with you in support of this legislation. And I think that bill was quite different than the final bill that was ultimately passed last year. And I think the bill that you ultimately got over the finish line, Ashley, was even more comprehensive than the bill that we were fighting for a couple of years ago.
Yes.
So what additional species were added to the bill language that weren't initially?
Yes. Well, and also I love that you bring this up, Brenna, because you're exactly right. We started, our first iteration was H297 in 2015 and 2016. As everyone knows, Vermont works on a biennium, and you were amazing. You stood right by me and my team. And it was so devastating when H297, it continually got watered down. And it's so funny because at the time it felt so sad, and I don't want to use the word hopeless, but it did feel a bit hopeless. And then if you just hang on and you keep pushing, you can see that actually something better opens up down the road, which is exactly the case with us. So you're right. The first iteration of the bill was just ivory and rhino horn. H99, which is what made it across the governor's desk, was expanded to include cheetah, giraffe, hippopotamus, jaguar, leopard, lion, pangolin, which is the most highly trafficked mammal in the world, ray, sea turtle, shark, tiger, whale. And I'm very proud Vermont added primates to that list. So, and not only did we add more species, and people say, well, why did you do that? The reality is, more species, you know, fast forward from 2015 to 2020, more species needed help. Most of your listeners know we're in the sixth mass extinction, which is greater than the loss of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. There's a background or a normal rate of extinction of 1 to 5 species a year. And today we're losing dozens every single day. And the number one reason, unlike the previous 5 mass extinctions, is humans. So, you know, every year that ticked by from 2015 until October 8th, 2020, when Governor Scott signed this, more species became at risk. So we were able to expand the definition of imperiled wildlife and actually make a much stronger law. So good things do come to those who wait.
And also not to, sacrifice, you know, what you believe to be the right thing.
Correct.
You knew that back in 2015, 2016, that the bill, like you said, was getting watered down to the point where it just really didn't have any teeth.
Correct.
And you waited. And legislation and all this changing the status quo, you know, it's not for the faint of heart.
No.
Just
no.
Because, you know, something is right and just doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. You know, if that were the case, a lot of things would have been banned a long time ago, not even just limited to wildlife.
Yep. Yep. So, you nailed it. And I think for me, if somebody told me back in 2012, this was going to be an 8-year process, I would have laughed and maybe said, okay, I don't think I can do this. So maybe it's a good thing I didn't know how hard it was going to be. But the reality is, if you believe in something, it's almost like you don't worry how long it's going to take. It will be frustrating, but I knew I was not going to stop until Vermont did this. And if you have that conviction, nothing flusters you, nothing bothers you. You just keep going.
So we talked about some of the hurdles, when amendments get attached to your bill and bills get watered down and compromises. And what were some of the biggest hurdles, you know, that you faced either most recently or over the last however many years that you've been working on this legislation, and how did you overcome them? You know, I know one thing that I witnessed, which is always very frustrating, and you only have so much control of the narrative, is when, you know, your good work gets hijacked by the opposition, and, you know, there's a lot of misinformation being spread, and that can spread like wildfire. And, you know, you always really need to be on the ball and, you know, ready and able to confront, you know, this misinformation that happens very rapidly. So that's something that kind of stuck out in my mind, and you jumped right on it, and, you know, you always had your fact sheets, and that's where being knowledgeable and credible, you know, has really, you know, made you such a success. But, can you share with us, you know, some of the biggest hurdles and, you know, how did you overcome them and how did you kind of stay the course and not get, you know, too dejected and wanting to just throw up your hands and walk away?
Right. So I think, again, the number one thing is conviction. If you have conviction, nothing will stop you. So I definitely had conviction, but I think wherever, whatever state you're looking at, I mean, legislators have a ton on their plates. So for me, this was of critical importance, but, you know, it's one of 100 things that a legislator might be trying to take care of. And I think the most important thing is knowing it's not mutually exclusive. I mean, I feel like if there's something that needs to be changed, we'll throw that in the mix. So, you know, if we said, well, Vermont's got so many other issues, this is just going to have to wait, that's going to defeat the whole purpose of understanding the urgency of this particular law. The opposition specifically, I think it came, obviously, in this case, it came from antique dealers, it came from gun owners, it came from a variety of people who I think just they didn't want things changed. But unfortunately, with knowledge, with information, comes the obligation to act. So I think what you have to do is try to find compromises where you can. I mean, New Jersey's law is the only law in the nation that has zero exemptions. So to me, that's a pretty amazingly strong, bulletproof law. But what happened was after New Jersey became the first state in the nation to do this, it became clear that in order for laws to happen, they needed to have some common sense compromise. So you want to make sure you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so obviously our bill, it has exemptions for some antiques, all musical instruments, and gun handles and knife handles, as long as it's less than 200 grams of ivory. So I think it's just a matter of trying to be reasonable, but like you said, knowing if the bill is actually going to become law and do more harm than good, which is what would have been the case back in 2016 with the first iteration, that's when you need to pull the plug and say, you know what, we need to start over. So it's knowing what's reasonable, and then it's knowing where you have to draw the line.
And also, you know, being just back in 2012 or 13, whenever it first started, you know, you were just one person. What did you do in the very beginning stages to mobilize and to get people to want to join you? I mean, you organized a march down Church Street in Burlington. I think this was back in 2016. Correct me if I'm wrong.
2015. Yep.
15. I mean, you filled Church Street. I mean, it was beautiful.
That's right. That's right. Well, you were there with me the day before making sure the route looked good. So Brenna, you've been by my side from the beginning. That is for sure.
But you are one person, and you know, you had such a tremendous showing. So how, from the very beginning, you know, just thinking of activists out there who have a passion, who feel they don't know where to go, you know, what was the very first thing that you did? I think you mentioned that, you know, you found out who wrote that book or the documentary, and you reached out to him, which
that's
I love.
Right.
I do the same thing. I find people and I research them, and then I call them out of nowhere, and they're like, "Who is this person?" I think that's wonderful. So, what are some of the other things? I mean, did you start a Facebook page? Did you post it on Front Porch Forum, which is a community email here in Vermont? What are some ways that you actually got the word out?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything. And you don't stop at anything. So, and I also like to add, I have not been paid one penny for this work. We are all volunteers, and I haven't put a penny into this. So this is, again, when people say, oh, well, lobbying and making a law, you need, you know, millions of dollars. No, you don't. You need a lot of passion and you need a lot of conviction. So I, you know, did this event. There was this incredible panel. I connected with some wonderful local wildlife experts, and it just, this little tiny seed was planted. And I started Ivory Free Vermont, which was the very first kind of iteration. And that's when kids around the state started hearing about me. I would speak in local elementary schools, and slowly but surely, just it became a movement. Kids were amazing. Teachers were amazing. Art teachers got involved. And then, of course, you want to make sure you have bipartisan support. So from the very beginning, we had Kurt Wright, who was a Republican, and Joan Lennis, who was a Democrat. And those two people, they came together and said, this is bipartisan. We need to work on this together. So, and then, you know, other people took notice. So it was just this slow but steady stream of spreading. And yes, Facebook and Front Porch Forum and answering anytime anyone said, Ashley, can you come and talk about ivory and rhino horn? I would say yes. So it was just this steady, steady spread. And then media picks it up and they start to pay attention. And then, of course, there's opposition. But even that's good, because that means that there's going to be a healthy debate. And that can ultimately, as it usually does, lead to progress.
I really like that you mentioned that, you know, you have not been paid a penny and you have not spent any money. I mean, you know, the Facebook page for Vermont for Wildlife doesn't cost anything. You know, letters to the editors, all of your outreach doesn't cost anything. So it's really important for people to, you know that it's not going to be some big cost prohibitive project. You know, when we had the legislation to ban coyote killing contests back in 2018, that was done primarily by Protect Our Wildlife. And, you know, we, you know, certainly don't have a lobbyist. We're, you know, we relied on the community, and it was really just, it was a community effort. And so I think it's really important for, again, people to remember that, you know, don't be intimidated by the opposition. Yes, Vermont does have some, you know, paid lobbyists at the State House that are pushing, you know, dangerous proposals impacting wildlife here in Vermont, but don't underestimate, you know, the power of the people, not to sound hokey, but
yeah, no. And I also think, I mean, my kids they'd laugh at me because, I mean, you know, they'd say, Mom, do you tell everybody about H99? and I say, yes. And you have to kind of be somewhat ruthless in how many people you want to become aware, because I believe in the inherent goodness of the human being. And I think once you can kind of, you know, wedge yourself in there and get a tiny second of their attention, 9 times out of 10, they're on board. And whether it's a quick email from someone I just met in Rutland, or a phone call from someone I met in Bakersfield, you know, that cumulative effort is what was so thrilling to see. You know, I will say we did have wonderful sponsorship from Main Street Landing, who very generously paid for the graphic design and the print materials. And I mean, really, that was the extent of our costs. And there was one woman who heard me speak at an event we did at Queen City Brewery with Tara and Peter Hetz, which was wonderful, just an awesome evening. And this woman, who's an elderly woman, she became probably our number one volunteer. She just was taking hundreds and hundreds of these awareness action cards and disseminating them to anyone and everyone she could. So it's that kind of, you know what, I'm not stopping at anything. And I'm going to bring this up to everyone. That's what gets things done.
And I think, you know, you really had so much credibility. And that's something that I take very seriously, because, you know, there's no quicker way to lose support and credibility than if, you know, you don't have your information correct.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you always had your fact sheets ready. I mean, anyone that was trying to oppose anything you were doing or challenge you. You always had, you know, your facts at the ready. And that's something that, again, we pride ourselves on. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, certainly a lot of this is very emotional. I mean, and we should be emotional about this, and it is emotion based. We're human beings. You know, we experience these things happening to animals, and we should have this feeling of wanting to help. But I think coupled with that, we always need to make sure that along with the emotion, that we are solid in our facts. And
absolutely, 100%. And I just along that, you know, emotion is not what's going to win any of these legislative battles. Emotion's wonderful. It can capture people's attention and capture their time and make them want to act. But it's science, it's fact, it's evidence. You're exactly right. That's where, I mean, that's what will win the victories and get people's attention. The emotion is second always to the science. I mean, and if I could just add, Brenna, you know, in terms of this particular, you know, year, people, the past year that we've had, people would say, oh my gosh, 2020 was such an incredibly difficult year. Of all the years in this 8-year process, for this to be the year, 2020, that this bill became law, you know, some people were shaking their heads. How can that be? And I think to some extent, it was using the science of this very pandemic that we're in right now. I mean, COVID-19 is a zoonotic disease. It leapt from animals to humans, just as HIV, Ebola, SARS, a number of other zoonotic diseases. And this particular one became a pandemic. So I think, you know, whether or not people care about wildlife, people obviously have experienced in horrific ways the ramifications of what happens when we continue to exploit wildlife. And so if you trace back the, you know, where did this particular pandemic come from, you know, you can look at that science all day long. So I think that also got people's attention.
That is such a great point, and I'm so glad that you brought it up, because it seems like both on the global, national, local level right here in Vermont, you know, it's business as usual for a lot of these decision makers and Fish and Wildlife agencies and other people who make decisions on wildlife policy. And yep, things have to change because, you know, the planet is changing, you know, with a warming climate and new diseases and these black swan events that are wiping out populations, totally unexpected, you know, nothing that we can plan for. Right. And, you know, we see too much of this business as usual, you know, pandering to special interests and not putting, you know, wildlife first. And now more than ever, we need to put wildlife first because, you know, I don't see things getting any better on their own, kind of continuing on the course of how we've done things, you know, historically. I mean,
correct. No, you're right. I mean, the idea that exploiting wildlife will not come back and haunt us has been completely debunked. We're living the reality of what happens when you continually exploit wildlife. So you're absolutely right. I think this past year has been a massive wake up call, and we need to pay attention.
And as far as, you know, going back to the credibility factor, which again, that is something that is very important to me, because, you know, it's something that we've experienced, and I know you've experienced, is that it's very easy for the opposition to try to discredit you by saying, oh, you know, they're just emotion based, you know, they don't have their facts straight. And, you know, we are wise to that. And, you know, we've always been able to refute that. And I think really important to remember is that our legislators and other decision makers, whether it's a select board, whether it's a city council, whether it's anyone who's in the position of power, this isn't what they're well-versed in. So they're relying on us as being the experts in whether it's, you know, banning the sale of wild wildlife parts or banning leg hole traps or banning, you know, coyote killing contests. They're relying on us to be the experts in
providing
them with the facts. And we never want to put a legislator or anyone who's, you know, advocating with us in a position where we're not going to be providing them with the right information.
100%. And I'll add to that, because that's a very good point. You make sure you have your facts straight. The other most important thing, in a way, next to the data, is being persistent. Again, legislators have so many demands just screaming at them, and they're all good. I'm not disputing the fact. I mean, there's so much work that has to be done in this state, and I'm so grateful for our hardworking legislators for tackling that every day. Where we come in, where wildlife activists come in, and just citizens, is the notion that when things start to slip from their agenda, it is our responsibility to be the squeaky wheel and get it right back up front and center. And I think there were many times with my experience where this could have just very gently just kind of fallen by the wayside. But every time that started to happen, I said, oh, no, this is coming right back. And I would like to kind of give credit where credit is due right now to Senator Tim Ash, because back in June of 2020, it didn't look great for H-297. We had gotten through the House committee, which is wonderful. They did a great job, but we hadn't even gotten through the full House yet. And there was a very limited window once the session resumed in late August and September. And I distinctly recall speaking to Senator Tim Ash, who was the head of Senate at the time. And I said, it's now or never. And he put his muscle behind it. And again, it was just, it's just making sure you don't let things fall through.
And I remember Chris Shadler, who I interviewed recently on coyotes. For those of you who don't know, Chris is a coyote expert. She lives in New Hampshire. And she lovingly refers to me as an ankle biter.
Yes, what a compliment.
I think you're an ankle biter too. And I think we need to be ankle biters, because we need to keep the pressure on. We can never feel like, oh, well, you know, I don't want to bug this person again. It is really up to us to keep this on the radar of
100%.
Folks. Always be respectful, like you said, and know that folks have a lot of stuff going on. This is one of many things, and it may not be their priority, but it is up to us ankle biters, yep, to keep it in their radar, because if not, you know, you can't blame them for going on to the next thing.
Absolutely. So. Well, and I will say, Brenna, to give you a huge round of applause, you know, when I think about this country and I think about all the good that Vermont stands for, being the first state in the nation to outlaw slavery, I mean, we have a legacy to uphold here in this state. And only 7 states in the country have outlawed wildlife killing contests, and only 12 states have outlawed the ivory trade and other imperiled wildlife parts. And Vermont is on that list, Brenna, because of you and me. But let's face it, that, you know, I really feel like your efforts with the wildlife killing contest put Vermont on the map. And I am so grateful that you're an ankle biter.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, that, you know, our efforts, you know, were unique. There's, yes, a lot of other states that have these laws on the books. And, you know, granted, you know, Vermont banned coyote killing contests, but, you know, I, not to get too off topic, but would like to see all wildlife killing contests banned, because there shouldn't be crow shooting contests. There shouldn't,
right,
be squirrel shooting contests. You know, no animals should be killed, you know, for prizes.
For folly.
Yeah, for folly. It takes the respect out of taking a life, and really just devalues these animals. And so we are not done on that front.
Correct.
So back to your legislation. I think you said, well, you can remind me, but how many other states still allow the sale of ivory, rhino, horn? Let's just kind of maybe focus on those two things. And are there any efforts underway in those states to do what you did? And are there any organizations that are kind of leading the charge?
Right. So Vermont became the 12th state, plus DC. So DC is on that, the list of doing the right thing as well, which means 38 states have yet to act. And to answer your question, yes, there's legislation in many of those 38 states. But again, it's just kind of percolating. It really needs a push. It needs, and to your whole point in this interview, it can be one person who's very busy, who's got a lot of other things going on, to just say, okay, I'm committed to this and I'm going to make it happen. We actually have a woman who has spent time in Africa. She's amazing. She did a huge amount of effort to get the push here in Vermont, Tara Hetz. Well, she's moved to Colorado. So she, the first thing she told me when she moved to Colorado was, I'm going to make Colorado be the 13th state. And I have no doubt that she'll do that. So I think, you know, the thing is we don't have 8 years to make this, you know, happen across the whole nation. So what I'm hoping is that Vermont and our story can be replicated in a much quicker way so that the 38 states can act quickly. The Humane Society US has been a wonderful partner, and they obviously have a great amount of insights into individual states. So I'm actively working with them, trying to make sure that we can identify what states are closest, what states need the biggest push, and so we can really have this become a domino effect.
Yeah. And I think, again, you know, the biggest takeaway I hope from this podcast is I want to take that fear and intimidation out of the process and empower folks to take action. You know, don't need to have a college degree or a high school diploma or any knowledge about politics. People just have to have a passion for a cause. Yep. And I often hear, you know, people are afraid to pester, you know, decision makers, whether it's legislators or their select board. But again, you know, I always remind folks that, you know, legislators want to hear from the public. You know, they are there to represent you. And, you know, you are the expert in your cause. And it is, you know, on us as activists to share all of our knowledge with these people who have the ability to change laws. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And we've had, you know, folks have success with their select boards and their city councils. So there's a variety of different ways, you know, to be a change agent, if you will. So Ashley, how do folks, are you still maintaining the Vermont for Wildlife website?
Yes. So we still have vermontforwildlife.org, and we'll keep that for a while, hopefully. But, you know, I think it's probably worth mentioning the states that have acted. So if your state is not on this list, or you have friends who are in these other states, I mean, that's where we need to put the pressure. So if that's okay, I'd like to quickly read the 12 states who have acted.
You're going to read the 12 states who do have laws, and then can you also read the states that need help? Because if we have listeners in those states.
Yes. So basically, of the 50 states in the nation, if you don't hear your state listed here, that means you need to act. So the states that have taken action are New Jersey, New York, California, Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, Washington State, Illinois, New Hampshire, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Vermont. And as I mentioned, DC. So if you didn't hear your state mentioned there, or you have friends in, say, Florida or Massachusetts, you need to call them and say, hey, go to vermontforwildlife.org. Because what we'd like to say is we've done all the hard work. So we have fact sheets, we have Q&As. We have, our designer has generously agreed to have his work be replicated in other states. So, you know, we're trying to create a kind of a blueprint. So somebody who wants to run with this, they can run with it in any of the remaining 38 states. There's no reason why someone should have to sit down at their computer and start from scratch. We've done all the work. So that's what my hope is. People can reach out to me through the website to see exactly where this goes next. I don't really know, but I am excited because I know for a fact Vermont's story will absolutely be replicated in other states.
And I think, Ashley, you know, you've made it so much easier for compassionate folks out there in other states like Florida, or Massachusetts, right?
Yes.
To take action. I mean, you put so much time and effort into those postcards and all of the information, the fact sheets. So really, you know, for someone to get involved in their own state to pass a similar ban will be relatively much easier than what you had to go through, because you were really starting from scratch. I mean, you put
together
over the course of years. So
that's right.
That you are happy to share that with other activists from other states is
absolutely
is, and I think that really may help people get it over the finish line. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to close with, or do you feel like we got everything? I mean, we could always have future podcasts too.
I'd be delighted, Brenna, to talk with you any day. You know, I think the most important thing, and not only for wildlife legislation, but for anything, is never giving up. If you give up, you lose and your cause has lost. So I would say, I mean, not to sound corny, but it's just the notion that you will not give up, that you will not ever give up on what you feel is right and just to make the world a better place. And again, looping back to wildlife, because that is so dear to you and to me and to many of our listeners, recent study has shown that populations of wildlife species around the world have declined an average of almost 70% over the last 50 years. So I think that if you only remember one thing from this podcast, it's that fact, over 70% in the last 50 years. And that, to me, there's such urgency with that, that I hope that you will really believe in yourself that you can make a change, because we need you.
I'm glad you mentioned that. And again, you and I could talk forever, but you know, the fact that these wildlife populations are in jeopardy, I mean, we're talking about, you know, other countries and other continents. We are talking about wildlife also right here in Vermont.
Absolutely.
We have river otters who are listed as a species of greatest conservation need, yet the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department leadership, you know, extended the trapping season on them.
Yep.
We have the muskrat population nationwide is on a severe decline, and no one really knows why. We still have one of the longest trapping seasons in the country on muskrat. You know, coyotes, there's basically zero information, population studies or anything on coyotes in Vermont. So it's important to think about things globally, but I mean, there are things happening right here in Vermont with wildlife that could very soon be imperiled. And
that already are imperiled.
Already are.
I couldn't agree more. Vermont, we can start right here.
Yep. So I would like to close this segment with a quote by Jane Goodall, which I know is a huge ally to your efforts specifically, Ashley, and for all animals. She's such a hero.
Yes.
What you do makes a difference, and you have to decide what kind of difference you want to make. And I think that really sums it up. And I hope this segment has motivated you to start your own campaign to help animals, whether it's wildlife, dogs, cats, horses, pigs, cows, crows, you name it. There are animals in Vermont that need your voice, and we are happy to lend a hand. If you'd like to run an idea by us or you have questions, email us at info@protectourwildlifevt.org. And I encourage you to please check out Vermont for Wildlife's website. They also have a Facebook page. And Ashley, can you just provide the website address again for Vermont for Wildlife?
Yes, vermontforwildlife.org. And we will love to hear from you. Everything you need to contact us is on that website.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ashley. And thank you, our listeners. And we will talk to you all soon.
Thanks, Brenna. It's been great.